Habakkuk. Habakkuk. A little short book in the group of books called the Minor Prophets in the Old Testament. Habakkuk. I always have to run through the order of it in my mind to be able to find it. Turn about one too many pages, you've passed it. Habakkuk will be going through the book of Habakkuk for 5 weeks. This will be week number one. If you're involved in the study or if you've been doing it on your own at home, I think you'll find it profitable. If you want to, there's still 5 or 6 study guides over here on the steps. Feel free to help yourself to them if you'd like one of them. This morning we're going to be looking at the first 4 verses. And I've entitled the message, Enough is Enough. Perhaps you have heard that someone say that before. Perhaps you've said it before. I don't know that I have ever said that, but I can sure imagine that I have a number of times. Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. Let's read our text. The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear, even cry out to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds. I have 3 points, but first I want to talk just a little bit about the book of Habakkuk. All that we know about this man, Habakkuk, is found right here in this short book. 56 verses, I believe it is. His name is mentioned 2 times in the Bible, and they're both right here in this book. Habakkuk. The little saying you see on your outline, who he was, nobody knows. But what he was, everybody knows. A book that makes up, I think it's less than 1%, easily less than 1% of the verses in the Old Testament, and yet it is one of the per verse by far the most quoted books. Taking into account its the shortness of it. Some have suggested that Habakkuk was a Levite that assisted in the music in the temple. And we're not going to kind of look at the verses that back this up, but you'll see that as we come to chapter 3 in the book of Habakkuk. It is a psalm. It is a song in the book there. Some have suggested that Habakkuk probably prophesied between 635 B.C. and 597 B.C. The evidence for this we'll see next week as John does the second sermon on the book. Dating the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans and the Babylonians are sort of synonymous terms for the same group of people. And it seems as if that what God is telling Habakkuk here may have been prior to the rise of the Babylonian Empire and prior to the rise of the strength and the force of the Chaldeans, because God tells Habakkuk that it's going to be hard to believe this. And it may not have been hard to believe if the Babylonians were already a world power. So perhaps this book was written and took place prior to that, just a few years prior to that. It perhaps was in the reign of Josiah, king of Judah. You remember the nation of Israel was divided after Solomon's death between, I think, one of his sons and one of the generals of his army, if I remember correctly. And the nation was divided. 10 tribes went one direction, and they were called Israel. And their capital, I believe, was in Damascus. The other two tribes became known as Judah, and they comprised Judah and Benjamin, and their capital was in Jerusalem. It is interesting that God had told David that the throne would be from his line all the way. And you can follow the kings, starting with David and Solomon, and follow them all the way through until Judah was taken over by the Babylonians. And it always is father, son, father, son, son, son. Even though there were instances of where a rebellion perhaps tried to change that, never did. The nation of Israel is quite the opposite. You may have a father who is a king, his son may follow him, but two or three times throughout the succession of kings, there is an anarchy and some other leader who is not following the physical lineage of those kings takes over. Not that way in Judah. Josiah was a king during this time, and is from around 600 to 650 or so B.C., and it's probably during the earlier part of his reign that this book takes place. The Habakkuk was written. So let's begin. Number one, talk to you about the prophet and his burden. You see in the very first verse, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. Now your version may say the oracle. The word, Hebrew word for burden means a weight, a load. It is a very common word in the Old Testament, and it is used primarily over half the time, I'm pretty sure, maybe two-thirds of the time, it is used for the weight that you would put upon an oxen or a donkey or a mule or something that is going to bear a burden, to bear a load. That's what the word means. But it is used of prophets, the burden which the prophet bore. The burden, this verse says, which Habakkuk the prophet did see. The burden which Habakkuk saw. What is it about this word that is used for a prophet? In our particular case here in Habakkuk, it says the burden which Habakkuk saw. What is it that Habakkuk had seen, or what is it that he sees that is a weight upon him? I think it's two things. One, it's what's going on around him that he sees with his physical eyes. He sees contention. He sees violence. He sees his own people, the people of Judah, taking advantage of one another. He sees them killing. He sees them stealing from one another. He sees his own people turned against one another in a variety of ways. And that is a burden. But he also has a burden because of what God tells him, because of what God shows him. And both of these things go hand in hand, and they are a weight upon his shoulders. How many of you, I think I've mentioned this illustration before. We'll see how many of you remember. Have you ever been in a room like before here at before church, which is a good example, when there's a number of people around, everybody's kind of having their own conversation, and all you can hear is kind of the din of talking going on around you? Or it may not be that big a group. It may be you may have, you know, six or eight people at your house and everyone's just visiting. And then all of a sudden, for some unexplainable reason, it seems like everybody just quits talking at once. Kind of like the air conditioner going off, turning off. You ever had that experience? It just seems like everybody got quiet. And somebody might say, well, somebody say something, or why don't everybody quit talking? The Dutch people have a phrase for that time. Does anyone know what it is? That's what I thought. You don't listen very well. The phrase is this: a minister just walked by. What does that mean? Are they afraid they're going to? They didn't trust their mouth. Or they already were talking about stuff they didn't want their preacher to hear about, so they turn it off. They shut up, right? I don't know if you've ever experienced that from one side or the other. Okay, I have, and John probably has too. You know, you go, you're in a place, and you walk in, and people know that you're a preacher, they know that you're a pastor, and all of a sudden everybody kind of gets quiet. Why is that? Well, we just had a suggestion of why it is. Is it because the preacher is so holy? No. Not. Y'all talking about somebody else, right? No, that's not it. Is it because the preacher is so righteous? Is it because the preacher is going to jump down your throat if he hears you say something that he thinks is out of place? Probably not. I mean, that happens. It's not who the preacher is. It's who the preacher represents. And we are reminded in those times, again, that there is a God. Habakkuk. I can imagine Habakkuk was not a professional prophet. He did not have a prophet salary. Perhaps Habakkuk was a Levite, as we talked about. Perhaps he earned his keep by working in the musical department of the temple. I don't know. But very few of the prophets of the Old Testament, if any, were paid to be a prophet. They were something else. But yet God used them to speak to his people in a way, and they became known for prophesying. They became known for proclaiming truth to the people. And just like our day, people are the same yesterday and today. When Habakkuk came down the street and approached a group of people, there was this feeling of uneasiness. This aura about him that people felt a little uncomfortable. Perhaps they felt exposed. Perhaps they felt naked. Perhaps they felt that Habakkuk knew their thoughts. The prophet seemed to have an unquenchable desire for righteousness. You could see that in the lives of the prophets that we know more about, like Elijah and Elisha and Moses. An almost unquenchable desire to speak the truth, to point out immorality, to point out failures in society around them. Do we have prophets today? I was watching a video, I think probably a YouTube video, of a song that I was looking for a worship team a year or so ago, and found on what I thought was it on a YouTube video. So I went and watched it to see if it was it, and I'm trying to, you know, going to learn the song, this kind of stuff. And during the, it was a concert, I suppose, there's, you know, a number of songs being sung, and so I was getting in kind of the middle of it, getting to the one song I was interested in. And the guy who was leading the worship, somewhere in there, began to speak in tongues, I suppose. That's what he was doing, and or some a language I didn't understand, and was talking and speaking, and then on the front row was this guy. And he stood up, and the video showed him. He had long, snow-white hair, long, snow-white beard, had a white robe to the floor that was wrapped around him, and he had a shepherd's staff in his hand. And he apparently was interpreting what the other guy was saying and prophesying to the audience. Thousands of people there looked like. Is that a modern day prophet? I don't know. Could be a modern day false prophet. It didn't do anything for me, you know, and especially the way he was dressed. You know, I'm not sure why that was necessary. But there are people, and there are churches, there are groups. The Mormons have what they clearly identify as prophets. I don't look for prophets in that sense today. But I'll tell you what I am convinced of. I am convinced that there are people, men and women alike, who have the gifting and the personality, not the personality is not the right word, but the gifting from God that compels them to stand up for truth. Those people, I would say, would have the gift of a prophet. Someone who cannot sit idly by while the world is reeking with immorality. Other Christians, and there's nothing against them. Most Christians are this way. They can kind of let that roll off. They don't condone it. They don't participate in it. But they're not driven to point it out. They're not driven and they're not burdened by it. It does not weigh heavy upon them like it does others. If we have prophets, I would say that would be what they're like. The prophet and his burden. The burden which Habakkuk, the prophet, did see. We always tend to think of the prophet and his bad message. But the prophet could have good news as well. In the scriptures, it makes that distinction. When a prophet came with good news, you usually will see the word blessed. The Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. A prophet was speaking those words, Jesus. That is called a prophecy that is good news. It's called an oracle of weal, W-E-A-L. An oracle of weal was good news. On the other hand, a prophecy that was bad news was an oracle of woe, W-O-E. Those were the burdens. And this book, Habakkuk, is an oracle of woe. Five times, I think, in chapter 2, you will see that word, woe to them. The word woe means damned. You are damned. We look at that as a curse word, and indeed, it is. You are cursed. Woe to you. Secondly, the prophet and his questions. You see, in verse 2, he says, O Lord, how long will I cry? How long will I cry out to you and you do not hear me? You will not hear me. In verse 3, he says, why do you let me see all this wickedness if nothing is going to be done about it? Habakkuk has been living and watching violence among his own people. He's been watching immorality. He's been watching things go wrong, things that are done wrong, and it seems like nothing is done. The law, the civil law that had the authority and the right to correct this, to straighten this out, was not being carried out. And it's been going on and going on, and Habakkuk is carrying the weight of what he sees. And eventually, he cries out to God, God, why do you even show me this if you're not going to do anything about it? If it's not going to be corrected, if justice is not going to be done, why even let me see it? And then we get to the third one. The prophet and his expectations. Now these are things that are not all of them necessarily told to us in the text, but they're easily, you can see they're easily implied that they are. Now let's go through them. These are sort of in a chronological order. The first one is this. Elijah, or Habakkuk, expects justice to be the norm in the nation of Judah. Don't you expect that? We do. We may have lived for so long with some things, injustices being done, but we still expect it. Because we acknowledge when it's not. That shows you that you do expect it. We expect justice to be the norm. This is what ought to be taking place. And Habakkuk expects that. He expects that justice would be the normal way of affairs in his land. The second thing is when violence is not answered with the law. He expects that the wicked will be emboldened in their wickedness. Would you expect that? If people get away with crime, don't you expect that they'll be a little braver about it next time? That they'll be a little more brash the next opportunity that they have? I think we do. Habakkuk. It's the same way. The third thing, when injustices abound, he expects the law to lose its respect and power. People no longer respect the law. If the law is not correcting the injustices in society, the criminals don't respect the law, and eventually the law-abiding citizens lose respect for the law. I'm there. All right? The fourth thing, when the law is not feared, he expects tyranny and anarchy. When the law does not do its job, the criminals are emboldened, crime becomes worse and worse and worse. There will come a point, Habakkuk, I think, expects that things will get so bad, and I know I expect this, things can get so bad that the criminal element is just anarchy in the streets, or people are forced, they feel forced to take the law into their own hands. Habakkuk sees his nation heading this direction. But Habakkuk expects something else. He expects God to move. He expects God to do something about it, and to do something about it sooner rather than later. Now I want to ask you this fourth question here. Why does this seem so relevant? As I read this, as we've been studying through the book of Habakkuk, I don't know about the sermons from here on out, because we don't know the end of the story in our day. But these first four verses, it seems like we are living just like this. And there are Christian people, probably most everyone in this room, feels some degree of burden for our country, for society, for what we see going on around us. You can look on a worldwide scale. Never before in the history of the planet Earth has the world, entire world, been so connected. Perhaps if you're in a third world country, it may not be that way as much as it is in the United States. But most people in the United States are connected to the world and can be connected to things that are going on in the world in a matter of minutes. Minutes. What happened the last few days in Paris? Anarchy, almost, in the streets. ISIS, all we've heard about for the last year or two or three. The tragedies that are taking place. Christians all around the world who are being martyred and killed for no other reason than they're Christians. This goes on. The Twin Towers, 14 or so years ago. And yet it's becoming a distant memory, isn't it? It's becoming the norm. At the time, it was shocking to us that this would happen on our soil. But now, if it happens, we are not surprised, are we? How quickly things change. Even within our country, among our citizens, there is violence directed toward those in authority. Bragging publicly and boasting and encouraging people to kill policemen. Riots in the street. The Black Lives Matter movement. And people cave in to the violence. And what effect does that have? It encourages it. It encourages it. University of Missouri. When the football players joined in the protest and said, "We'll not play," what happened? They got results. Interesting. Why is it that the coach backed up the players? I'm being judgmental. Could it be because he's getting paid $2-3 million a year and he needs a good football team? I don't know. But I know that when people who can riot and people who can break the law, and people who can loot and get what they want with no consequences for their actions, then you'll see more of it. You'll see more of it and more of it. Occasionally you'll see what is classified or talked about as the lone wolf violence. Sometimes these, in our experience, the last few years, has been related to Islam. But Not always. Not always. Sometimes it's just someone who is mentally deranged. It is someone who has been horribly mistreated. Susan and I were talking the other day about when we were in school. In fact, we was talking about this, well, it might have been me and Daniel, the guy that I went to school with, who was mentally handicapped in the public school system. He was horribly mistreated. And I made the comment that I can see how someone in that situation could become so desperate, so angry, or whatever, that they take it out on whoever's in their path. These things go on. You know, when I was a kid, we had a went to church, a little rural church just about the size of this one here, and the church doors were never locked. Intentionally, the church doors were left open so that the church members would have access to the church or anybody else that thought they needed access to the church could come. And here's something you need to know. This past week, we installed a camera system in this church. So you need to pay attention to what you're doing when you're walking around. You're being recorded. And we did it for security reasons. Because of things that like happens in our day. This has happened in my lifetime. The change, the shift has gone from one to the other in my lifetime. Injustices in a lot of other ways that are not violent. I'll give you an example. A month or two ago, I had a stress test done, checking my heart out to see if I was having, if I had heart problems or whatever. And when I did the stress test, it was Dr. Jordan in Little Rock, and this lady that was his nurse, you know, I was talking to her, she was preparing me to go through the stress test and stuff, and she had said, was talking, and she said she had worked with him for 20-something years, and you know, I was telling her I'd only heard good things about him, that kind of stuff. And as we talked, I told her, I said, you know, I have had heard one bad, I did meet somebody that didn't like him. And that got her attention, you know. He said, well, what's the deal? And I said, well, it was, there's this young lady in her late 20s who is grossly overweight, really obese. And she was trying to get Dr. Jordan to put her sign off and get her on disability. And he wouldn't do it. He said, your problem is not your heart. Your problem is you need to lose weight. I'm not going to do it. You need to lose weight. You know what her parents' reaction to that was? They got mad. Who do you think they got mad at? The doctor. The doctor. And I told her, I said, I like that. I like what he did. Looking for something that cost me nothing. Greed. We are filled, our society is filled with greed. Things that they may not be violent, but they are injustice. Injustice still the same. And you start taking some of that freebie stuff away and see what happens. Then you'll have anarchy in the street. 10 or 15 years ago, we were having a Bible study in this room, and it'd be interesting to see if anybody is here that was here that night. I'm sure there probably is. We were sitting right back there in the Bible study, 5 or 10 people here, 10 or 15 years ago. And I won't think it was kind of in a little, maybe not the dead of winter, but it was cold. And all of a sudden, we're sitting there, it's dark outside, and in walks this man. Anybody remember that? Susan? He don't remember stuff. In walks this man, and we're sitting back there. He walks in. He's a little bit scruffy looking. You know, he's got on this heavy, long army coat, if I remember right, solid green army jacket type thing. He walks in. He doesn't say a word to us. He walks all the way right down here. And stands here, and I'm not sure what he does, but it looked like he was, I got the impression he was trying to atone for his sins or something. You know, he was doing something. I don't know if he's, you know, genuflecting or what he's doing. And then he messed with the offering plate and turned and walked out. Meanwhile, what did we do? We sat back there going, well, when he leaves, did you get up and follow him out, John? It's either you or me, one. But he ended up, I knew, I went to school. The guy was 5 or 6 years younger than me in school. I went to school with his sisters more than him. He was a little younger. I knew the guy. I could call his name. Some of you would know his family. Why he did that, I don't know. Now, I'm going to tell you the difference between then and now. If that happens this Tuesday night, you know what's going to happen? We're not going to be sitting back there watching him. We're going to be close enough to him, somebody is, that they can grab a hold of the guy. Right? I'll say, get him, Susan. Why is that? Because of the things that have happened in just 10 or 15 years. These things go on. They go on, and they weigh heavy upon our minds. I was watching the Republican debates, and of all the 10 or 15 Republican candidates, if you had to pick out one person who has a radically different philosophy than all the rest of them, and it's not Donald Trump, who would you pick? Rand Paul. Rand Paul. Libertarian. A libertarian. You know, I want to believe that the libertarian philosophy is right. There's something about it that attracts me, that I like. And I wish that I could swallow it. In the libertarian mindset, and this is probably, somebody might take issue with how I characterize this, but freedom is the thing. Liberty is the thing. Those fewer laws, the fewer involvement that government has in our lives, the more it fits the libertarian outlook. And I guess that's what I like. I like that. But there's, and I have read a number of books, articles and stuff by libertarians, and I keep thinking there's something that's not right here. And I think I have put my finger on it. Maybe not. But the libertarian, it seems to me, the ones that I've read follow, have the mindset that if you just teach people right from wrong and see they see it to their benefit, they'll do right. the idea of supply and demand. If I'm a carpenter and I'm a shoddy carpenter and I'm dishonest, you don't need a law to prevent dishonest carpenters, according to the libertarians. They will eventually be weeded out because people will not give them business. And that makes sense. If they are thieves, you know, whatever the case may be, if they're incompetent, the issue is a supply and demand. And it let the free market take care of itself. I like that idea. I like those thoughts. But there's one thing I can't swallow. And that is this, that if just because someone knows what is best for them doesn't mean that's what they're going to do. Because I think they fail to take into account that we are sinful by nature. Our heart is deceitful. And above all things, we are desperately wicked. Some people will destroy for no other reason than to destroy. They get no good from it. They get no satisfaction from it except an inner satisfaction that satisfies their evil. I live in this world. I live in a world where injustice is prevalent. I live in a world where violence is rampant, where our politicians and our statesmen do nothing because it is right, or very little because it is right. They will do it because it meets their immediate needs for themselves. I live in a world, in a nation, where Christians are increasingly being marginalized, where Christians are increasingly being openly scorned and mocked and blamed for everything that comes down the pike. I live in a world where exposure to evil breeds more evil in our hearts. Your children, for those of you who have young children, have access, easy access, to unspeakable evil. And it will be hard for you to be able to put boundaries upon your children because of the world and the technology that they need, put that in quotes, today. And it seems to me that at least some of the time, we Christians who are concerned about such things do not have the answers of how to deal with it. And I'll tell you, I don't. I don't have the answers. And time goes by and we hope for the best. We hope that our children and our grandchildren are not seeing things that they have no business seeing. We hope they are not seeing things, being involved in things that we could hardly even comprehend when we were their age. yet children nowadays, if they grow up to be adults and they are successfully sheltered and righteously sheltered from such thing, there won't be one in a thousand who will be successful, I doubt. It is too prevalent. It is too before us. It is too in your face. It is too much where you almost have to be this close to it, a click or two away on your computer or your phone, and you're there. I live in that world. I live in a world where violence not only puts me at risk, there's probably three or four or five people sitting in this room on any given Sunday, they'll have a firearm on them. And I'm glad. I'm glad. I live in a world where violence puts us at risk, puts me at risk, and I feel forced to do things I would have never thought I'd be doing 20 years ago. I'm being squeezed. I am becoming a slave to a society who demands things of me that I would not ordinarily willingly give. I am spending money on things I ordinarily would never have spent money on. It is costing you. It is costing me. On a good day, when I am thinking, perhaps as God would want me to think, I might can get a little excited just wondering what God is up to. What's going to happen? What the future is going to hold. Yes, I may be martyred. Yes, I may lose everything for no other reason than I'm a Christian. But at some point, God's going to do something. And on a good day, I might be halfway excited, wondering what that is, even if it means suffering. But on a normal day, my hackles get raised. My teeth are bared and my fists are clenched. And my guns are loaded and cocked. And I'm sick of it. Sometimes I ask God, how long is this going to go on? How long can this go on? That's my question. It's interesting to me that Habakkuk had the same question. The weeks ahead, we'll see what happens in Habakkuk's case. In the years ahead, we'll see what happens in our own. I'll show you a t-shirt that I bought. It quickly got too little for me. They shrink. I know you probably can't read this. Some of you are close enough can. Inepticracy. All right? It says, a system of government where the least capable to lead are elected by the least capable of producing, and where the members of society least likely to sustain themselves or succeed are rewarded with goods and services paid for by the confiscated wealth of a diminishing number of producers. You need to digest that a little bit, right? I can't remember. Maybe on eBay or somewhere. I'm not sure, but anyway, if you want to look at it, it'll be up here. You can read that and digest. Let's pray. Lord God, there's nothing going on in the world that you don't know what is happening. And I might be frustrated, I might be aggravated, I might be angry. But it doesn't hasten your steps one bit. Father, I thank you and I love you. If everything I have is stripped from me, even life itself, you will have been good. You are good. Father, would you help us as we see the turmoil that is in this world around us, the stupidity, the wickedness, the total disregard for human life. God, help us. God, would you do a work in our day of turning people's hearts to you? Father, maybe it only comes through, maybe you only intend for it to come through suffering. But God, glorify yourself. Save souls. This day we live.